Businesses love to talk about their sustained growth. And in fact, Amazon, as a case in point, gets in trouble with its shareholders all the time for building market share by growing rather than by building a gigantic cash reserve like Apple has, for instance. It turns out that sustained growth may be an oxymoron, though. Douglas Rushkoff writes in his new book that what is truly sustainable may be non-growth. The new book is throwing rocks at the Google bus, How Growth Became the Enemy of Prosperity. He says, while the growth at all costs mentality has long been a problem, it's only gotten worse over time, posing major problems for today's tech CEOs, their employees, and the global economy as a whole.
As I did my research, I found it's really, for the past 75 years, corporate profits over their net worth has been going down. It's not really just an internet story, but the end of a cycle, the end of a certain kind of industrial business that just keeps growing and growing. I mean, they're still good at growing. They're just bad at deploying the capital they've accumulated. You know, so they're like these obese institutions that are storing cash in their fat, but they can't actually create any muscle or any economic activity.
There's two ways of looking at this. One is the sort of short-term view last 100 years, which I consider sort of the short-term view here. And that's very interesting. But let's just put that on hold for a second, because there are societies in the history of civilization that came to a kind of no-growth, sustainability equilibrium in the way that they interact with their resources around them. Do you think the way this works is that there's some like giant explosion crash, and then sustainability is our lesson that we learn? Or do you evolve to that point of sustainability?
Well, whichever one happens, whether it's an apocalyptic explosion or a smooth transition, our strategy has to be the same. In other words, what we do is we need to build local, resilient, sustainable businesses. We need to start optimizing for the circulation and for transaction, not for the extraction of capital from communities. You know, we have to start looking at how can workers be part owners in the companies that they work in rather than just employees, so that we start really not redistributing the wealth that we've already earned, but kind of pre-distributing the means of production so that everyone can participate in value creation. I don't know which way it's going to go. It's you know, it's hard to tell, but I'm hoping that certainly now, as enough people look at the headlines, when people see that, oh, look, Twitter's making $500 million a quarter, but it's considered a failure, you know, and that's for doing 140 characters. That's pretty good money for a 140-character app. Or people see what's going on, you know, that all these people are having to drive Uber cars and all these other people are having to rent their apartments through Airbnb. You know, people are becoming aware of the fact that the growth of all of these companies is not leading to any sort of participation or distribution of the assets to others. So we're being forced, really one by one, we're being forced to make decisions in new ways. And those new ways tend to favor a more stable, resilient, steady state economy. I mean, and that's the income disparity, which has been, you know, growing over time, ends up really exacerbated by these accelerated digital business models. You know, you look at the effect of something like Airbnb or Uber or Amazon Mechanical Turks, you know, gig employment on people. And it really makes these digital companies look like almost like software that's been designed purely to extract currency and value from people and turn it into share price for companies. So you just see that it's not just a competitive landscape, but an extractive landscape.
I have to ask you, I mean, I guess everyone is going to ask you this question, but throwing rocks at the Google bus, are you referring to the protests that took place out in the Bay Area?
Yeah.
Related specifically to consumers being resentful of the gig that Google employees had with their own transportation shuttle system?
Yeah. I mean, it's looking at the way originally the protests in San Francisco were about how sort of foreign Google employees and the bus that they were using were changing real estate values in San Francisco. Even around the bus stops, the rents hadn't just doubled like everywhere else. Around the bus stops, they were 30% higher than they were in the other parts of San Francisco. And the local businesses were going out of business because they couldn't pay their rents. So Google was changing the fabric of the community and not in ways that the residents could even participate in. So it really became, well, it was a real problem, but it was also a very symbolic problem. It was one that we could all relate to as we look at a company like Google, which we thought was on our team, you know, that this right. was going to be the way that the economy got restored and we were all going to be able to create value and have new kinds of jobs. And the digital economy didn't work out the way we thought it would, that these companies are getting bigger while the rest of us are getting poorer, you know. And yeah, a couple of weeks after the original protest, some protesters in Oakland actually threw rocks at the bus. And I remember a lot of tweets coming through saying, yay, you know, people were excited about it and wanted to know why I couldn't cheer along with what was happening, because everybody was mad at Google for being, you know, they were snooping on us with the NSA. It was a particularly dark time for Google. And I said, I couldn't applaud this because I know people on those buses. You know, they're just kids trying to get a programming job and stay employed for 3 years before they burn out and make enough money. And I started to think, who is there to blame? And you can't even really blame the CEO of Google because he has to answer to the shareholders. So you can blame the shareholders, but that's the likes of us with our 401k plans. We've got a S&P 500 fund in there that owns Google, and we're going to sell it if it's not making money. So the only way to really correct this problem is to start looking at it more systemically. How do you actually make a business that is going to create jobs for people around you? You know, even if Walmart and Uber started to look at their businesses from the perspective of economic development, I'm going to move into a town just like I move into a developing nation. How am I going to create enough economic development so that I have customers, so that I have employees, so that I can stay alive another 5 or 10 years?
So I can help people. They'll like me and they won't throw rocks at my bus. And I can stick around.
Exactly. And that's not necessarily utopia, but it's just kind of, well, just all getting along.
Douglas Rushkoff is author of Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus, How Growth Became the Enemy of Prosperity. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.